Bab, very distinct, Stephen Greaves's voice saying with rising panic. Rena's hurt. Somebody, everybody, Rena's hurt. Dr. Akinwe, Carlyle says, please go to Dr. Khan. Mr. Greaves, help is coming, please stay off the channel. That done, he waits in silence. He approves of the fact that Private Phillips is taking his time. This is not a situation where an off-the-cuff answer will do. Nothing out there, sir, Phillips says at last. Nothing warm, anyway. Which doesn't rule out Hungries. But Hungries didn't make the thing they've just rolled over. It was a barricade stretched across the full width of the road. Mainly branches and twigs, but the grinding squeals from Rosie's underbelly suggest that there were some rocks in the mix, too. Whatever it was, it's now under them. The jolt was from the treads rolling over the rocks and stones before Sixsmith could bring Rosie to a halt. Any damage? Carlyle asks the driver now. Sixsmith consults the diagnostic board, shakes her head. Nothing in the red, sir. We're good. Should I get out and verify? Not here, Carlyle says. Move us on a mile or so. We'll take a look when we're well clear. Sixsmith rolls Rosie forward an inch at a time, alert for any suspect vibration, any hint of trouble. She waits until she can see the barricade in the rear views before she hits the throttle. In the event, they drive almost 4 miles before Carlyle calls a halt. He waits until the forest on both sides thins out, and they're in relatively open country. Even then, he makes Phillips do another 360 with the infrared goggles. In the crew quarters, he assembles the escort and assigns details. Sixsmith will stay at the wheel, Foss will man the turret guns, he himself will go outside with McQueen and Phillips to inspect the damage, if any. The colonel was expecting to have to field anxious questions from the science team, but they have migrated en masse into the lab. While McQueen and Phillips kit up, the colonel goes astern to check on Dr. Khan's status. She fell down when Rosie stopped. She is still on the ground, ashen pale, not speaking or trying to move. Her lab coat and shirt are thrown open, and Akinwe holds a stethoscope to her bare abdomen. The remaining members of the science team stand around, extraneous and unhappy. Stephen Greaves is rigid with misery and fear. His head is bowed, and both of his fists are pressed hard against his forehead. Almost imperceptibly, his upper body rocks backwards and forwards. John Seeley kneels beside Khan, both embracing her and holding her head up off the cold steel of the deck. His cover, the colonel assumes, is now blown even for the slowest of uptake. As if on cue, Dr. Fournier enters from the engine room, blinking in the harsh light from the neon strips. Akinwe assures the colonel that there are no bones broken. Carlyle's glance goes down to Khan's abdomen. The baby seems to be fine too, Akinwe says. It has a very strong pulse. Good, Carlyle says gruffly. I'm glad of it. All of you, stay in here, full lockdown. We'll assess the situation and then we'll tell you where we stand. He kneels and squeezes Khan's hand, just for a moment. I'm relieved you weren't hurt, he says. Me too. Khan mutters. She tries to smile, but the effect is far from convincing. The colonel leaves her there, after instructing Dr. Akinwe to see her safely back to her seat and strap her in. Take care of Mr. Greaves, too, he adds. Do you have any suggestions as to how I might do that? Akinwe inquires politely. Carlyle doesn't, so he says nothing. He refreshes his e-blocker, noting with approval that McQueen and Phillips are doing the same. Then, with the two men at his back, he opens the midsection door and steps out. Into a raw, clear afternoon. Mist lies on the ground, but from the knees on up there's a good line of sight. Perhaps there are hidden attackers snaking through the long grass on their bellies. If so, their snaking skills are commendable, and they have found a way to fit grass blades with silencers. Notwithstanding this, Carlyle elects not to speak. He signals to McQueen to cover him and Phillips while they check the treads and the underside of the vehicle. Once again they feel the absence of Private Lutz, who knew Rosie's skin like his own. They are able to verify that they haven't blown a tread, and that there is no visible damage to the chassis. Confident now that they are alone, Carlyle brings Sixsmith out from the cockpit to join them. As the most competent engineer out of the five of them, she is best qualified to make a full visual inspection of the tread connects. The colonel also orders her to check the rear-mounted air vents. The vents are high enough off the ground that it's unlikely that they would have been touched, but he doesn't want to neglect something so crucial to their survival. Everything is fine. Or seems to be. "Was that an ambush?" McQueen demands. From the crew quarters he wasn't able to see a thing when they actually rolled over the obstacle, which is clearly a sore point. "There was definitely a built barricade," Carlyle says, sticking to what he knows. "Branches, stones, some sharpened stakes." "Stakes?" McQueen is incredulous. Carlyle sketches in the air. "Lengths of wood, about 4 to 6 feet long, split at one end and with glass shards wedged into the fork." "It was an ambush," Sixsmith says flatly. "You need to see this." On Rosie's rear right flank there are shallow scratch marks, scoring the olive drab paint. Below them, a small soot-blackened ellipse shows where someone tried to set a fire. The four of them stare at these baffling signs, as though they're trying to read them like runes. "Last night?" McQueen demands at last. "Has to be," Sixsmith says. "We were A1 at Lloyd's after we got out of Invercrae. I went over every inch." "Why didn't this show in the MAC checks?" the colonel demands. Sixsmith shoots him a hunted look. He has impugned her, and she feels it, especially after running right into the barricade. "Sir, the MAC is about moving parts. We don't go over the armour." McQueen is still focused on the invisible enemy, the crucial point here. "So someone got through the motion sensors and the traps and had a go at us." "Yeah, but with penknives," Philip says with a nervous laugh. "Penknives and a cook-up. Who tries to stab a tank?" McQueen is not amused. He scans the empty horizon, scowling like a demon. "Who tries to stab a tank?" he repeats. "The same people who went up against us in Invercrae yesterday with slingshots. The same people who killed Lutz with fucking kitchenware. They followed us." Carlyle shakes his head. He has considered this, but it seems entirely implausible to him. "And got ahead of us? On this road? How, Mr. McQueen?" "No, if this was an ambush, it was laid for someone else. Someone who's not riding inside 4 inches of steel and ceramic laminate." "But there is another possibility," he allows in his own mind. "It could be someone who saw them coming and preposterously underestimated them. If he and his team had stepped out to inspect the treads on the spot, would woad-painted savages have run out of the trees to attack them with spears and clubs?" "No, of course not. It has only been 10 years since civilization fell apart. People don't devolve to the Stone Age in a single decade. In any case, Phillips did a thorough scan with the thermal goggles and saw nobody in the woods beside the road. Even if you were to accept the hypothesis that this could have been done by savages, there would still seem to be a logical contradiction in the idea of savages who set an ambush and then wander off to pick flowers. Despite his orders, Dr. Fournier emerges from Rosie, exiting via the cab rather than through the midsection door. Unused to the high running board, he almost slips and falls. He's very flustered as he crosses to join them, indignation and belligerence clearly visible on his face. Something else is there too, disguised and half-effaced under these banner headline emotions. Carlyle puts it down to fear. It is understandable for the doctor to be afraid and to want to hide it. There is no reason, as far as he knows, to believe that Fournier has anything else to hide. Fournier is trembling uncontrollably, and his stomach churns with nausea. He has just disabled the radio in Rosie's cab. The circuit board he pried out of it is sitting in his pocket now, along with the Allen key he used to detach the radio's fascia from the console and get access to its innards. All the while he was working, he was in full view of the colonel and his soldiers. They could have turned at any point and seen him, and then come back to the cockpit to find out what he was doing there. It was, quite simply, the bravest thing he has ever done, and he is amazed at himself. He was amazed, even as he was doing it, to find that he was capable of such reckless courage. Now he is suffering the reaction, surplus adrenaline making his body rebel against his conscious will like an unbroken horse. There is no way that he can come across as his normal self, so he lets the soldiers see that he is out of control. They will mistake it for cowardice, but that's fine. For once, their lack of respect for him will work in his favour. "Is it too much to ask that you brief me on what just happened?" he asks Carlyle. The pitch of his voice wavers. "Good. Let it." "We hit a roadblock, Doctor," the colonel explains. "We took no harm, and we can be on our way again." Which is very good news under the circumstances. But flushed with the success of his recent exploits, Fournier senses an opportunity to make it even better. The brigadier's orders to him were to see that Rosie was delayed. This looks like a perfect justification for a delay, and if there is no actual danger, then so much the better. He demands details, and more details on top of those. As civilian commander, he announces with calculated shrillness, he has a right to know. The colonel visibly contains his impatience. He gives Fournier a full and circumstantial rundown of recent events and speculations. The rest of the escort stand in the tall, sodden grass, swapping glances of contempt and disbelief. As he listens, Fournier considers how best to play this situation, how long a standstill he can negotiate. "We can't go on until we can be absolutely certain there's no danger," he says, when the colonel is done with his report. "I refuse to submit my crew to any unnecessary risk." On Fournier's left-hand side, but not out of his line of sight, one of the soldiers, Sixsmith, shakes her head in wonder. "Doctor, the only sensible response is to keep going," the colonel says, levelly. "If there is a threat, the best thing we can do is outrun it." "I absolutely disagree," Fournier says. "We have no idea what we might be running into. Rosie should stay right here while your men reconnoiter further up the road and ascertain whether there's anything else in our way." "And if there is?" Carlyle's voice is stiff with the effort of being polite. "We'll still be making the same decision, which is either to plough through or to go around. It does no good to have these soldiers expose themselves on foot to hazards that Rosie is well equipped to deal with. You can see we took no damage." Fournier digs in. He really doesn't have any choice, and he can't afford to lose the argument. "This trap could be the first of many. To sound us out, test our resources, so they can hit us harder next time. We can't assume that because there was no damage done this time there's no threat. In fact, they could be deliberately encouraging us to underestimate their capabilities." The colonel raises both hands to indicate the emptiness all around. "Who," he asks, "are they?" Fournier is aware of the risk he is taking, the very real dangers he is inviting. If whoever set the barricade did mean it for them, then moving on quickly minimizes the window for further ambushes. Standing here and arguing widens it. But he has a job to do. The fate of Beacon is in his hands, and it outweighs the fates of these individuals. Even his own fate, although he shies away from that thought. He wants very much to believe that the real threat is small, even while he talks it up into a crisis. The adrenaline that flooded his system after his act of espionage in the cockpit has at last begun to ebb. In a more measured voice, he draws his line in the sand. Driving on into more roadblocks and ambushes is not an option, Colonel. If you refuse to carry out proper reconnaissance, we'll have to take other countermeasures. We have a vehicle that was specifically designed to function off-road. I suggest we use that capability. What the actual fuck? Private Sixsmith says, making no effort to lower her voice. The Colonel puts a thin veneer over the same sentiment. We'll lose time, Doctor. A great deal of time. The going will be harder and we'll have to stop earlier when the light gets poor. And the slower we travel, of course, the easier it is for any potential saboteurs to follow us. Are you sure this is what you want to do? Entirely, Fournier says. Permission to speak, sir, Private Sixsmith says. Carlyle nods. Going overland all the way means taking longer, and that's got knock-ons. We'll run out of water unless we restock, but what I'm wondering is what happens if we blow a tread. You're qualified to deal with that, aren't you? Fournier demands. I've done it as a drill, Dr. Fournier, but I'm not Brendan Lutz. If we get into serious trouble, I'll take twice as long and I'll do half the job. It probably won't happen, but I thought you should know going in. These hills all around, these are the Cairngorms. Off-road means uphill, and it will get pretty steep pretty quick. If we land in trouble in there, we might not be able to pull ourselves out again. Carlyle nods. Thank you, Private. I appreciate your honesty. Fournier doesn't appreciate it all, but the word Cairngorms has triggered a memory, and now he teases it out. An ace in the hole, or at least an argument that he can win. There's another reason why I was considering a detour at this point, he says, trying to look like a man who has thought deeply about this and is not just flailing around at random. The cache we missed on the way up is very close to here, on Ben McDewey. If we leave the road and go east, overland, we'll hit it within a day. The idea lands like a dead fish. Everyone is looking at him as if he has just suggested that they camp out in the open and watch the stars. Doctor, it was your decision to omit that cache in the first place, Carlyle points out brusquely. You argued that it would be too difficult to reach. I don't really see how our situation is any more favourable now. If anything, I always held open the possibility of retrieving it on the return journey, Fournier breaks in. And now, with no findings of any consequence to report, it's our last chance to find significant data. Why should this lot be more significant than the other 99? McQueen demands. Sixsmith and Phillips exchange a glance of amused contempt, which they make no effort to disguise. But the Colonel says nothing. Clearly the mission statement still has some sway over him. Fournier has picked the right lever. The road is straight all the way from here to the Firth, he presses. One highway going south. If we stick to it, we give these people a very easy target. They can set their ambushes at any point they like and we'll roll right into them. Overland is slower but safer, and it gives us an opportunity to retrieve the cache. Carlyle nods at last, prompting angry mutters from the soldiers. Very well, he says. We'll go overland. As far as Ben McDewey, at least. Private Sixsmith, you'll keep the speed low and stick to level ground wherever possible. Level ground? Ben McDewey is a bloody mountain, McQueen points out. Sir, I volunteer to scout the road ahead and see if it's safe. Thank you for the offer, Private McQueen, the Colonel says. Your concerns are noted, but for now we'll do as the doctor suggests. We'll find the cache, and then we'll rejoin the road at the Fourth Estuary. Hopefully we'll only lose a day. Dismiss, Dr. Fournier says, which is pure wishful thinking brought on by having won his point. The soldiers wait, seemingly deaf. Even McQueen doesn't move until Carlyle gives the nod. He may hate the Colonel, Fournier reflects sourly, but to take orders from a civilian? Clearly he hates that idea even more. The new regime in Beacon will have its downside for a thinking man with no military background. Fortunately, his own status will be secure. He will have proved his allegiance beyond doubt. Chapter 29. Private Sixsmith turns Rosie through a tight arc and cuts her loose. With no buildings to worry about, she is quick and confident, almost showy. There is barely a jolt as they leave the asphalt for the wild green yonder. Phillips is back up in the turret. The midsection platform is empty now, since the bumps and shocks of their overland progress make standing up more of a challenge. Dr. Fournier is in the engine room, the Colonel and Sixsmith in the cockpit. Everybody else is sitting in the crew quarters. Everybody except for Dr. Khan, who has retired to her bunk. The excuse she gave was that she was still feeling woozy after her fall, but she flashed John Seeley a look as she retreated, if a sideways removal of less than 2 yards counts as a retreat. Now she's waiting for him to take the hint. Waiting with the curtains closed, and with a caldera of tears boiling inside her. She feels a surge of undirected anger. She never cries. The worst thing about all this is that she has lost control enough to feel she might cry. Almost. Almost the worst thing. Poor Stephen. He was so helpless when she fell. Earlier, when he saw her mixing up some emergency medication for herself, he was right there with a chemical solution to her chemical problem. But when he saw her hurt, he was paralyzed. No sign of John. All he has to do is say he's crashing early with a good book, one of the 3 on board. He must have seen her give the high sign. But he doesn't come. Does he know what she wants to say to him? Is he staying away in order to stop this box from being opened? Not going to work, John. It's coming, ready or not. Anyone feel like a game? McQueen's voice, faux casual. He lives for his poker, and the worse his mood gets, the more he needs his fix. There are murmurs of assent from Foss, Akinwe and Penny, a flat no from Stephen. Then John's voice, the weariness just as studied as McQueen's nonchalance. Count me out. I think I'll read. She hears him cross to the bunks, the metallic rattle of his feet on the boost step, then a creak as he settles. She's waiting for one more sound, but it doesn't come. He's taking his time, playing it cool. Dealer's choice, McQueen says. Akinwe declares that his choice is Oxford stud with a high-low split. As the bidding starts, there is, at last, a muted swish of fabric, Seeley's curtain being drawn across. Good night, John boy, Foss calls. Good night, Calamity Jane, Seeley replies, which causes Akinwe to giggle like a schoolboy. John waits a good 5 minutes before rolling his mattress back and removing the top slat. His face appears in the gap directly above Khan, peering down. He is instantly alarmed by the sight of her red-rimmed eyes. Hey, he says, his voice a murmur designed to stay within the bunks. You okay? Khan shakes her head. John finishes the excavation and leans down to join her, insofar as that's possible, to close the gap, at any rate. In a crazy way, the risk is less because they're doing this by day and on the move. The engine noise will help to cover any sounds they make, and nobody else is likely to head for the bunks any time soon. Tentatively, with due regard to the narrow space, the crazy angle and her fragility, he puts his arms around her. He doesn't ask any questions, just waits for her to talk. Which she does. She has held it in long enough, and to hell with stiff upper lips. When we were running for cover in Invercrae, I got a contraction, she says. She talks into his chest to mute the sound, also so he doesn't have to look at her flushed, out-of-control face. When it didn't come back, I thought it must just have been a stomachache. But this morning I got 3 in the space of an hour. I've been dosing myself up with homemade tocolytics, magnesium sulfate at first, then Stephen told me there was nifedipine in the med kit. I'm fine now, but I'd lay 10-1 odds I'm going to drop this payload before we get anywhere near Beacon. There's a long silence. His arms tighten around her just a little, transmitting reassurance. Okay, he says at last. So you have the baby in Rosie. It's okay, Rena. We can make the lab sterile, and you're surrounded by biologists. We know how it works. Plus, Lucien's got masses of first aid training. Penny, too, I think. He'll be as safe here as anywhere else. Safer, even. You name me another maternity ward that's got its own flamethrower. She smiles at the incongruous image. In her current mood, she finds it has a certain insane appeal. But the thought of what's to come still weighs on her. The known unknowns of giving birth inside a tank in the middle of a war zone. She feels a sudden dizzying sense of dislocation, a keen awareness of unfathomable distances between here and Beacon, between the past and the present, between the world as it is and how she would wish it to be. Paradoxically, though, these thoughts give her pause. They don't cow her into despair. There is the baby now, a new and unknowable factor. The baby could be the bridge over all these abysses. "Hey," she says, trying for a bantering tone. "Do you want to volunteer to pick up that last specimen, Cash?" Stark horror makes John's eyes open wide as saucers. "Rena, it's halfway up a mountain," he protests. She shakes her head. "Near the top, I think. 800 meters up. Do you want to give birth on a rock ledge?" He hugs her close as if he could protect her from her own recklessness. "I was kidding," Khan whispers. "Don't." Chapter 30. The land east of the A-82 is rugged and broken, with a topography that changes from mile to mile. Rosie makes indifferent speed even with full daylight. As the sun drops and the shadows lengthen, she slows to a crawl. The poker session is equally desultory. Brendan Lutz's ghost hovers over it, making the usual raucous banter seem like a slap in his ectoplasmic face. Finally, the game dribbles to a halt. McQueen strolls out to the midsection to oil his gun and to brood, something that he feels is best done alone. He is unused to giving way to his emotions, or at least, he corrects himself wryly, to being aware that he is doing it. It sits badly with him, like most things that have happened since Inver Cray. He admitted he was wrong to fire the flamethrower. The colonel had a chance to admit, in his turn, that, orders or no orders, McQueen pulled all their asses out of the fire. He didn't do that. They could have met in the middle, but they didn't, so they have retired to their corners instead. At some point, the bell is going to ring for round two. In the meantime, they've got someone on their tail, and McQueen knows in his gut that it's the exact same bastards who killed Lutz. Said bastards have cars, or, his best guess, bikes, and they know enough to stay out of the range of the infrared scopes. Wouldn't have been hard to slip down some back crack out here in the fucked-up wilderness and flank them. Find a good spot to dig in and wait for fireworks. So leaving the road was pretty much the stupidest thing they could have done. It makes them a little bit harder to track, sure, but they're the only thing moving out here, so how hard can it be? And the slower they go, the more chance the Inver Cray posse have to get ahead of them again. Tonight, tomorrow, or the next day, soon, anyway, they are going to find themselves in the middle of another surprise party, probably a lot wilder than the last one. When that happens, they're going to need him. Need him on the big guns, up in the turret, laying down serious hurt. And he will do his duty, as per the oath he swore when he joined up. He'll do whatever has to be done to keep them all alive. Even if that means putting a bullet in the colonel's head and assuming command himself. While he is musing on these matters with the rifle completely disassembled, the robot comes tripping through from the crew quarters, heading for the lab. McQueen snaps out a warning, but the kid steps nimbly between the components and the grease rags. Doesn't touch a spring or a bolt. McQueen finds this irritating without being able to say why. "This is delicate equipment," he says sternly. "Each of these little bits and pieces has got a job to do, Sunshine. Don't mess them up." Greaves turns round and faces him. Well, that's probably stretching it a little. The robot keeps his eyes on the ground the way he always does. But he is looking at the ground in front of McQueen in a way that's maybe a little sassier than usual. He points to the dismounted pieces of ordnance laid out neatly on the floor, and as he points, he names them. Operating rod, bolt, firing mechanism and trigger guard, magazine, takedown pin, pivot pin, charging handle, bolt carrier assembly, buffer assembly, spring. Considering how inflectionless his voice is, it's amazing how much defiance and sarcasm it carries. McQueen is nonplussed and even a little impressed. "Well, hooray for you," he says. "Ever use one?" "Yes." Of course he has. Everyone in Beacon has to do their civil defence, even people who manifestly shouldn't be allowed to use sharp pencils. "Ever hit anything?"
"No."
"Right. So you stick to your test tubes and I'll look out for the guns, okay?"
"Okay,"
Greaves agrees. He walks on into the lab, but he mumbles something as he goes. "What was that?" McQueen calls, because he's not taking any cheek from this reality-challenged little snot. The robot stops and half turns around, so he is talking to his own shoulder now. "You're going to get a hammer follow," he says, and he slides the lab door across between them. "The fucking hell you say," McQueen says to the closed door, indignant, like anyone could tell that without even bending down to inspect the gun parts up close. But of course he has to check now. And of course, because what's a joke without a punchline, the robot is right. There is wear on the hammer face and on the sear, so McQueen probably would have got a hammer follow and a bad misfire sometime in the next 10 or 20 shots. He changes out the sear spring and the disconnector. He is thinking dark thoughts when he starts, but by the time he's done, he finds it hard to keep from grinning. He set out to school the robot and got schooled himself. That is pretty funny, any way you look at it. Everything is a lesson. This one is about not judging by appearances. Just because the kid has a face as empty as a bucket with a hole in it doesn't mean he's stupid. And just because he creeps around like a whipped puppy doesn't mean he's got no spirit. Everyone is special, right? Chapter 31. In the end, it's McQueen and Phillips who climb Ben McDewey and bring the specimen cache down. They're professional about it, but they let their irritation show. If going cross-country was a bad idea, parking up to run errands makes it catastrophic. But Sixsmith makes it easy for them, taking Rosie up the shallow slopes of the Cairngorm Plateau almost to the summit. It's such a bravura performance, they're barely aware they're climbing. "Door to door," she jokes, as she brings them to a halt at the midpoint of the Larry Grew directly below the peak. "Keep the engine running," McQueen tells her. "We're not sticking around." It's cold as hell on the slope, and the ice makes the going precarious. But 15 minutes slog brings them out above the tree line. The world opens out suddenly. They can see Bray Riach to the west, and lonely Ben Nevis beyond like a sleeping god, who has turned his face from them, pulling the mantle of the snow up around his shoulders. Right at their feet, the valley dips and bends all the way down to the loch in switchback curves like a roller coaster. Phillips stops to gawk. Stubbornly resisting the beauty of the vista, McQueen urges him on and up. He has seen the splash of orange on the ridge above them, and wants very much to get this over with. Phillips is looking thoughtful as they climb the last 100 feet to the cache. It's an unusual enough occurrence that McQueen feels it needs to be checked out. "What?" he demands. He grudges the spent breath a little, and the gulp of frigid air he swallows to replenish it. "I was just thinking," Phillips admits. "I wonder what we look like from space." McQueen looks around at the rust-brown scrub and general desolation. "Like two ants on a turd," he grunts. "They reckon you used to be able to see the Wall of China from the moon," Phillips pursues, refusing to be sidetracked. "But by the time it all went to bits, there would have been lots of human stuff you could see, wouldn't there?" They've reached the cache by this time. They lean against the rock to rest up for a few seconds before they get busy again. Cities and towns would have been big grey areas, Philip says, going on for miles. Only now they're not, are they? The forests have gone in and taken over again. From 100 miles up or so, it would all look the same. London would just be more jungle. So here we are up on a mountain. And I bet this bright orange dot here is one of the last human things you could still see from all the way up there. McQueen gives a snort. The condensed breath hangs in front of his face, a visible index of his emotion. Most of the satellites fell out of the sky long ago, so this is academic in any case. But he doesn't see what's so great about leaving your mark on things. You have a life, and then it ends, and you're dead. Living it is the point, not proving to other people that you were there. The whole thing is really just water pouring down a plug hole, but that's absolutely fine. Standing water gets stagnant. "Let's get this done," he says. He opens up the cache and takes out the first of the cylinders. The seal seems to be intact, but there's nothing growing inside the glass jar, just a smear of brown jelly at the base of it. He's seen enough of them by now to know that that's wrong. "Bloody waste of time," he mutters. "What? Why?" McQueen shakes his head. It's not worth explaining. The cold is starting to bite into him, and the way down is going to be harder because they'll have to be careful not to damage the specimen jars. "Come on," he says, "load up." There are 12 jars. They take 6 each, stowing them in their packs between layers of wadded towels. Phillips dawdles, distracted by the view and by unprofitable thoughts. When they're done, he's still eyeing up the cache itself. McQueen can tell he's thinking about history, and the point where he butts up against it. He's about to snap his fingers under the private's nose, but then an idea occurs to him, and very much to his own surprise, he voices it. "Leave your dog tags." Phillips gives him a sidelong glance, alarmed at having his mind read so easily. "For future generations," McQueen says,
"in case there are any."
"Why the fuck not? A colonel will have my guts." "The colonel won't care. I doubt he'll even notice." "Go on, if you want to. We haven't got time for you to write a personal message." Phillips nods slowly. He unfastens his dog tags and sets them down in the bottom of the cache. He fastens the lid back on carefully, testing it to make sure that it will hold against the insistent easterly wind. "All right?" McQueen tries to keep all inflection out of his voice. "Yeah." "Then for fuck's sake, let's go." He gives the plastic crate a ringing kick. It stays where it is. Steel brackets at each corner have been driven down into the rock, holding it firmly in place. "You're all good, Phillips. That's what eternity sounds like." Normally, Greaves finds the lab a calming and comforting place to be. It's a place full of certainties, and it's a place where new certainties can be hammered out. But today he can't find comfort and can't make himself be calm. He keeps seeing Rena falling backwards, her face twisted in pain and shock, hearing the sharp huff of breath as she hits the floor. His perfect memory torments him with perfect reproduction. She could have died. In many different ways, the fall was potentially fatal. Her head could have hit one of the storage or base units, causing a hematoma, intraparenchymal hemorrhage, or crush injury to the brain. The shock of the impact could have brought on an early labour, with significant risk of death from postpartum bleeding, infection or hypertensive disorders. Conversely, she could have suffered a miscarriage, necessitating surgical removal of the dead fetus in an environment in which medical support and expertise are limited. Greaves runs through all the scenarios he can think of that would have ended with Rena lying dead at his feet. There are dozens. Though none of them happened, he feels them clustering around him, thickening the air in the lab until he starts to hyperventilate. His vision darkens. If Rena were to die, what would he do? But that's the wrong question. What can he do to make sure she doesn't die? They are surrounded by risks both quantifiable and otherwise. Granted, they are inside an impregnable tank, but outside its hull is a world where life expectancy has dropped back to levels not seen since the early Middle Ages. Even Beacon isn't safe, although it is safer than Rosie by several orders of magnitude. He will have to be vigilant until they get back there, and he will have to make sure that if dangerous situations arise, the risks are borne by others. The soldiers, for example, who have the best weapons, the most relevant skill set, and a specific brief to protect the science team. They should be ready to fight and die to protect Rena if the need arises. He will be ready too. He is ready, right here and now, and that won't change. He will keep her safe no matter what. With his mood a little restored, he turns his attention to the tissue samples. But the calm does not last. The samples and the findings he is getting continue to confound him. Should he classify the dead child as a hungry? Amazingly, and it hurts a little, burrows through his nerves and makes them twinge, he is still undecided. 4. The boy had the cordyceps infection in an advanced form and some of the salient behavioural symptoms. Specifically, he had the consuming urge to feed on fresh protein from a living source. Against. In other ways, his behavioural repertoire was more like that of a human being. He was still capable of thought and of emotional attachment. If he was an animal, he was a social animal, and a tool-using one. A hungry, then, but with provisos. A hungry of a type that Greaves has never observed or seen described. He notes, with a slight prickle of alarm, that by using the personal pronoun he has partially prejudged the question he is meant to be deciding. That isn't like him. He watches himself for subjective error all the time, alert for premonitory urgings of presumption or prejudice. His mind is an instrument, and you have to keep all your instruments in balance if you want them to be fit for purpose. The brain. The explanation for this paradox has to lie in the child's, no, the specimen's, brain. Cordyceps is abundantly present there, as Greaves has already verified. But natural brain tissue is healthy and robust. And whereas in a regular hungry the tide of native neurotransmitters has ebbed once and for all, in this brain roughly half of all chemical messengers are present and correct. So who is in charge here? The human or the fungus? And either way, what is the afferent mechanism that carries orders from the control room, wherever that is, to the nerves and muscles of the body? Greaves draws off more samples. He adds more stains and reagents, searching all over again for the brain's missing messengers. Dopamine, acetylcholine, adenosine, noradrenaline. He doesn't find them. They're not there to be found. But he finds something else. Checks, finds it again. And again, and again. The brain is swimming in mycoproteins, long-chain molecules manufactured by the fungus. Greaves has dissected and studied the brains of 50 or 60 hungries, and he has never seen any of these molecular structures before. A suspicion strikes him, a hypothesis. With a micropipetting frame, and one of Rosie's carefully maintained population of sprag-dawley rats, he is able to stimulate measurable brain activity with low concentrations of each of these fungal proteins. The results are consistent, predictable, and repeatable. The mycoproteins are neurotransmitters, running the brain's errands for it in the absence of the regular staff. Cordyceps is doing good deeds by stealth. Its mere presence messes up the chemical balance of the brain, which is why so many of those native neurotransmitters have dried up. But now it is repairing that imbalance with its own exquisite forgeries. The mass of fungus in the brain has turned itself into a protein factory, It is manufacturing copies of the missing neurotransmitters in the form of long-chain mycoproteins built to order. The fake, fungal neurotransmitters seem perfectly capable of doing the job the real ones would have done, carrying nerve messages from the human brain tissue to the peripheral nervous system, to the rest of the body. This is the main trick in the cordyceps repertoire, of course. But in every other hungry he has examined, every hungry ever documented, the result is a hostile takeover. The fungus hijacks the host. In this boy, cordyceps was filling in the gaps in brain function caused by its own presence. Building bridges instead of torching buildings. It was helping the brain to think, not tripping it up and hog-tying it. Greaves feels as though his head is splitting open. Not with pain, but with the chain reaction of thought on thought on thought. This is a find that vindicates the entire expedition. But it's so much more than that. It's... what? The Holy Grail. The Philosopher's Stone. The Elixir Vitae. The cure. If he figures out how to fake it, how to make an uninfected brain do whatever this brain is doing and turn the fungal invader into a friend and fellow traveller. A symbiont. When the pressure in his head gets to be too much, Greaves sits down quickly on the floor of the lab and hides his face in his hands. He can do it. He knows he can. He can make a vaccine. One by one, he defines the procedural obstacles in his mind and considers how they might be addressed. This will have to be a live vaccine, not even attenuated. And it will be heterotypic, including not just cells from the pathogen, but also cells from this child's spectacularly modified brain. Embed the symbiotic tissue like a seed crystal to teach a normal human brain how to welcome the invader, how to collaborate instead of resisting. But there are thousands of human brains in Beacon. The task will be huge. He calculates the volume of serum that would be required, and how it might be obtained. 5 minutes later, he is still sitting in the same position, still paralyzed by the implications of what he is about to do. Chapter 32. They're moving again. Back down across the plateau on a roughly southwesterly vector. Foss is up in the turret and wishing very hard that she was somewhere else. All through the day she has been seeing things. Flicks of movement in the firs, the long grass, behind the occasional rock ridge, or up on the elbow of a messy tumble of scree. Nothing odd about that, of course. There are plenty of things out there that might be moving. But it doesn't feel quite random enough. It feels like every time she doesn't quite see something, it's the identical something she didn't quite see last time. There is some trick of tone or colour or velocity that makes her scalp prickle with déjà vu. It's just paranoia. It has to be. Living in a tank will do that to you. Any kind of enclosed space, for that matter. The horizon is too close and it never moves. Then, when you get up in the turret and take a look outside, any movement you do see gets exaggerated. It takes a while to push past that to get your eye in again. But it shouldn't take all bloody day. The afternoon is petering out into tardy, sullen evening. Rosie seems to empathize, slowing more or less to human walking speed. She will be stopping soon, since driving cross-country at night on unknown terrain is outside even Sixsmith's skill set. The sky starts to put its sunset colours on, which is a fine thing to see, and distracts Foss from her growing obsession for all of 5 minutes. But the rapidly cooling air gives her an opportunity to try something new. She takes out the UV glasses. Toggled to N normal, they are maximally receptive in the 22 to 33 degrees Celsius range, and at a distance of less than 100 metres. On that setting, they show Rosie as more or less alone in the endless night. There are a few yellow-green blurs at ground level, where small nocturnal mammals are hunting and being hunted. The rest is cold, passive, blue. Foss is prepared to buy that, but there is one more thing she can do to see what the knight has up its sleeve. She resets the goggles to E Enhanced. In this mode, she can access the headset's processing software and tweak the resolution to focus on a specific temperature range. She goes low, then lower, then right to the bottom of the gauge. And Jesus Christ Almighty, the little bastards are everywhere.
What are we talking about? Fournier asks for about the 10th time. What exactly are we talking about? Give me facts, private, not conjecture.
Well, I wasn't a private when I signed up for this job, Foss reflects. And I'm sure as hell not a private now, so clearly you can't have been talking to me. Accordingly, she addresses herself to the Colonel and to McQueen. They're all jammed into the crew quarters, elbow to elbow, so there's no need for her to raise her voice. Everybody is right up in everybody else's face except for the robot, who has flattened himself against the latrine door out of pure holy terror of someone accidentally touching him.
These things are in the blue, she says. Cold, passive, shaped like people, but if they were people, they'd be dead. They don't show up at all unless you dial the contrast all the way up. And even then, they're so close to background, you pretty much only see them when they move. I'd put their core temperature around 13 Celsius.
She speaks slowly and clearly. Part of her wants to yell and wave and point, but this is her first official debriefing in her new role and rank, and she wants to do it right. Plus, it's not as if they're going anywhere. They are dug in for the night now, having lost what was left of the light 10 or 20 minutes ago. Bad timing, but it's not as though Foss could have done what she just did any earlier in the day.
That temperature reading is spot on for hungries, Seely says.
Foss is grateful. Someone had to play the straight man here.
Yeah, but the movement isn't, she says. They were jogging along on either side of us, keeping pace with Rosie but not closing. And they were in formation, like a kind of a wedge on either side, with one pacemaker and then a bunch of them strung out along a widening line. Does any of that sound like hungries to you?
Nobody answers. The Colonel takes the goggles and goes to see for himself, leaving everyone in the crew quarters taking turns to open their mouth, find nothing to say, and close it again. McQueen catches up quickly, though, and he ends up in the same place Foss did.
If these are the guys who set up that barricade...
They can't be, Akinwe interjects. We've covered 40 miles on bad ground since we left the road. Even hungries would have hit the wall by now.
Foss begs to differ, but she doesn't bother to say it. They stopped to go up the mountain after all. And you hear stories about squads driving for days on end in a jeep or a Hummer on good tarmac, with a hungry chasing their tail the whole way. It's a moot point, though. She doesn't think these are hungries. She has no idea what they are. She didn't even mention the creepiest part, which is that they're pint-sized. Human body plan, just way too small. Man-eating hobbits? Feral 10-year-olds? The Colonel comes back from the midsection and hands the goggles back to her. He's very quiet.
Foss has to ask, "Did you see them, sir?"
He shakes his head. Nothing in sight.
"But they're out there," Foss blurts. "I didn't imagine this."
"I don't for a moment believe you did, Foss," Carlyle says. "I'm assuming they're still close by, and that they went to ground when we stopped."
"Wouldn't have had to stop if we'd stayed on the road," Sixsmith says. Her voice has a raw edge to it. Everybody turns to stare at her and she shrugs, defensive but still angry.
"I'm sorry, but it's true. We could have outrun them on asphalt and we could have kept on going through the night if we had to. As it is, we're stuck here until morning. Assuming they tried to trap us with that barricade, we finessed ourselves into the trap when we ran away from them."
Fournier gets to his feet, all on his dignity but also really rattled.
To Foss, he looks like he's standing up to add to his physical size the way a scared cat does.
"May I remind you," he says frigidly, "that going off-road was a decision made by myself and Colonel Carlyle jointly, in response to a real threat."
McQueen gives a mirthless chuckle. "Nobody saw a threat apart from you," he says, "but I imagine that happens to you a lot."
Carlyle moves in quickly to shut McQueen down. Ours not to reason why, evidently.
"That's enough, all of you. Foss, is there anything you can add to what you've already told us? Numbers? Appearance?"
"I saw 8 of them," Foss says. "There's no doubt about that, she took the time to count. But there could easily be more, because like I said, they were running in a pretty loose sort of formation. Maybe I was only seeing the ones who were closest to us. There could have been more of them hanging back or flanking us. I wouldn't have got much of a reading through the trees."
"Were they armed?"
"I can't be sure, sir."
"Did you get a sense of what they look like?"
Foss could have done without that question, but she answers it anyway, knowing that she's going to sound like an idiot. "They were way below normal adult height. The tallest one I saw was only about 4 feet or so."
She hesitates for a moment, but there's no point in holding back details that might be important. "Visible light was poor, obviously. That's why I went to enhanced thermal. But it looked like some of them were holding things. Weapons, maybe."
"Oh my God," Dr. Penny bleats. She turns to look at Khan. "I told you, Rena. I saw children down by the loch right after the cult, you remember?"
"Children?" Dr. Fournier's tone is one of bewilderment tinged with contempt. "We're not being pursued by children."
"I just said they were small," Foss snaps, all out of patience. "Did you hear me mention children?"
"Pygmies, then?" Fournier inquires snidely.
"It's a shame you weren't properly trained in observation."
The colonel comes in again, saving Dr. Fournier from a short, sharp meal of rifle butt.
"Please, let's deal with the situation on the ground. Since we don't know the first thing about what we're facing, we have to assume that their intentions are hostile and prepare accordingly. I want a 3-man watch throughout the night. The cockpit, the turret, and the midsection platform. Sixsmith, let's have the intracom wide open at all points so we'll all know instantly if there's a sighting." As Sixsmith heads aft, Foss does the maths.
"Sir, a 3-man watch?"
"I know. With a man down, one of us will have to double up. That might as well be me, since I've had the least to do today. You and Sixsmith will take second watch. Mr. McQueen, Private Phillips, you're with me. Dr. Fournier, you and your team had best get some sleep. We'll move on as soon as there's adequate light."
"With respect, Colonel." It's Khan speaking up this time, which shouldn't come as any surprise since she's got the biggest mouth of anyone on the science team. Foss hasn't forgotten that idiot jibe. But she hardly ever makes a peep when the Colonel is talking. For some reason, he gets a free ride while Khan talks to the rest of the escort like they're shit on her shoe. Even now, she is respectful, almost apologizing for disagreeing with him.
"I don't think we should move on. Not right away. I think we need to find out what these things are."
She looks around at Fournier, at the rest of the white coats. "Don't we? I mean, look at the facts. If they're that cold, they're not baseline human. The safe call would have to be Hungries, especially if they've been keeping pace with us across all this distance. If you were human, trying to maintain that speed, your heart would burst. But Hungries don't use tools, so this doesn't add up. We have to find out what it is we've got here."
"I said I didn't see what they were holding," Foss points out. Although maybe she did. She just isn't sure. Until she is more than happy to be disagreeing with Khan.
Which is mutual, clearly. Khan rounds on her.
"The barricade back there was a tool," she says coldly. "It was meant to break our treads or trap us. That's why I think we should stop and check this out. If they're Hungries, we need to know how they can make that kind of calculation. Or build structures, for that matter." We're not sure that they did, Celia objects.